This is Dear Analyst, episode number 65. And today I'm super excited to have Katie Donovan, who is the VP of Data and Insights at Sports Innovation Lab, talk to us about how she transitioned from a career in marketing, business development, sales to a career in data. Turns out she was doing a lot of data work also in her previous career, but we'll have Katie talk more about that during this episode. So Katie, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So we'll just start right off and get into, can you tell us a little bit more about your background before you got into your current role?
Yeah. So I have spent about 15 years, a little longer. I'm working in data and technology, but from a very kind of marketing, sales, external narrative facing position. So using a lot of proprietary data technology systems, helping to build out some of the data systems that we were using for various different B2B and B2C conversations. But ultimately my role fell on the less technical side for the kind of bulk majority of my career. I'm working to actually take different data sets or databases and turn them into data storytelling and narratives that would then be brought into different revenue conversations or partnership development. And for the most part, did this from a fan-based data perspective. So the first part of my career was with an ad agency where I was actually focused on grocery. But then after that, I transitioned into working for Viacom, and before they were Viacom CBS. So looking at how fans of TV shows like SpongeBob or Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or Jersey Shore would translate into different revenue and product opportunities, creative development, even content development, production development, things like that, but how we really translated what we were seeing from a fan engagement perspective and understanding our fans, and especially the younger fans, so your Gen Zs, before they were named that, and understanding what it meant to actually have real conversations with them and develop real product for them. And then that translated into actually starting to work for a couple of different startups, both in a direct and in a consulting capacity, and eventually translated into working at Spotify. And at the time when I came in, they were about just shy of 60 countries strong. It was right around their 10th anniversary. And they were really going through a really incredible kind of upward trajectory inflection moment where they hadn't really figured out how to properly and consistently take all of the data that they were sitting on and translate that into consistent narratives and consistent ways of talking about and utilizing that data in both B2B and B2C contexts. So a lot of my work focused more on the B2B side of things and building out how we did proprietary research and data exchanges with clients like the NBA and Ford and Nike and a number of different kind of blue chip clients, but then also making sure that for everything that we were saying to those clients, we were also finding consistent ways to carry that same narrative through to our B2C side of things. Because in a lot of cases, our clients were also our customers. They were also subscribers to Spotify. So when we were sitting in a business meeting with them, if the narratives weren't aligned and they were seeing something as a customer when they're on the platform versus as a client when they're trying to do ad sales with us or research with us or whatnot, it was finding ways to create consistent data narratives across that. And then from there, that's when I actually made a little bit of a jump. So I went from the entertainment spaces into sports. And I did this very intentionally. I, in leaving Spotify, really realized that what matters to me a lot, and I had formed a nonprofit while I was actually just prior to going on with Spotify that I ended up dissolving while I was at Spotify. Side hustle nonprofit is not, it's not a very easy thing to do. But I realized in leaving Spotify that my real kind of purpose meets passion is finding ways to have a positive impact on the world, and truly finding ways to use data to have that positive impact. And so I ended up meeting through my husband, who ended up becoming my co-founder, Brenda Andress, who was the, at the time, the commissioner of the Canadian Women's Hockey League. And we started talking about specifically a lot of the challenges that are faced in women's sports and really trying to understand how we could better tackle those through data and technology for sure, but also through true fan mobilization and really connecting with the fan where they are and in different ways that are based on the behaviors that we see that are indicative of the women's sports environment, getting the existing fans to engage more and then getting more fans to come into that environment. And so we started She Is Sport together and started building that out. It turned into the first time that every single major women's professional league, as well as a number of the men's organizations, the unisex leagues and organizations, all of that really stood together and came together in an effort to support the growth of women's sports. And through working in that space, I mean, that was 2018 until the present, I'm working in that space really taught me about just the severe inequities that exist in and biases that exist in the data that is currently available and accessible in the sports industry. And so it started really getting under my skin to the point that I realized I needed more of the direct technical expertise to really start building the systems and the things that I wanted to build in order to be able to truly utilize the data that was available or to collect better data was really the goal for this space. Mm-hmm. And to do it in a really scrappy way, you have to have the technical skills yourself. So I made the decision to finally, probably a 5 years at least too late decision, to go back to school. I ended up getting accepted into a program at Columbia that was a pretty intense bootcamp program for data science, and going through learning the technical skills behind Python, machine learning, big data utilization, going through ETL processes, pretty much everything. SQL, although I really don't care for using SQL, so we can talk about that later, but just different tools, tricks, things of the trade that would help me to then be able to turn around and actually say, okay, now not only do I understand data storytelling and not only have I worked with data scientists, but now I can actually code and build this stuff myself. And so then the culmination of all of that turned into Sports Innovation Lab and where we are today, where they are not only working at the forefront of the sports landscape when it comes to data and technology, but they are with the most recent project, the Fan Project, specifically looking at how can we democratize access to data for the entire industry? And how can we really help to, in doing that, bring more equity into the space for women's sports, especially, and giving them real data, real resources around the growth opportunity that exists within that space.
Awesome.
That's my story.
So many different things we could dig into. I kind of wanted to rewind a little bit. You mentioned something that kind of caught my attention, which was using proprietary data systems or helping build some when you're at Viacom or at some of, you know, before your current role. Mm-hmm. Like, can you remember an example, or can you speak to any examples of like these systems that you were using, like how they were structured, who owned them, how you were pulling data out. Do you remember any of those kind of details about those systems?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll actually use Spotify as a good example of that. Because one of the things that we started really looking at when I was there was that Spotify was sitting on something like a billion data points a day that they were pulling in and not really knowing how to translate that into actionable resources for our ad sales business or our sales and partnership business as a whole, or really understanding how to translate that into true product opportunity and what that just kind of total business narrative could look like from a data-centric and insight forward perspective. Mm-hmm. So we started evaluating, okay, how can we actually dissect the data, clean it in different ways that will allow us to actually productize what it is that we're sitting on top of. And so one of the early stages, and they've definitely gone way deeper with this now, one of the early stages of that coming to fruition was through the personalization, the algorithms that they were using for things like Discover Weekly, Release Radar, even New Music Friday, and being able to analyze people's music listening behaviors. What we started to see in the data was trends around the actual various different moments that they might be in. And so through using that kind of algorithmic understanding, we could at a very large scale analyze literally millions of people's listening behaviors and say, okay, based on what we're seeing and kind of the trends and the patterns in this listening data, we can make a pretty sound assumption, like a pretty sound understanding that this person is cooking dinner right now, or they're commuting, or they're exercising, or they're at a party. So there was this moment-based contextuality that was being brought into the mix just by properly evaluating the data around the listening habits. And of course, then the type of music, like there, it was a lot, like there was a lot of different variances to that. Like we looked at beats per minute in the type of music to be able to assess various different like energy levels that might be present as a additional correlation. We looked at different device understanding. So, you know, were they listening on their desktop? Were they listening on their mobile phone? We looked at the types of playlists that they were creating at the time or where they were saving things to. So there was a number of different on-platform behaviors that the data was capturing that allowed us to kind of put together these dictionaries of what does it mean to be in this moment? What does that look like from a listening behavior perspective? And then what does that translate into in terms of how an advertiser might better evaluate that moment and say, okay, if I'm Nike and I'm wanting to connect with a person about, you know, a pair of shoes or about the latest gear that we have or something like that, targeting them when they're in the exercise moment is most likely going to be the most receptive time when that person is going to say, oh, this is relevant to what I'm doing right now. I'm more welcoming to this type of messaging or this type of ad being served to me in this moment versus if they're about to go to sleep or if they're cooking dinner or some of these more kind of outlier moments where you're just sitting there and going, why do I care about Nike right now? Like, why do I care about it? You know, their latest tennis shoes or their latest workout gear or whatever it is that, you know, they would be promoting. So there were things like that that allowed us to better contextualize and bring that through that analysis into a space that was helpful for growing the business and growing the revenue side.
Gotcha. Very cool. And it sounds like when you were starting to work with Shia Sports, you realized all these data inequities. And can you kind of walk through like that moment when you realize like, I don't want to just be like a consumer of the data that I'm looking at or just someone that has to accept whatever I'm given, to this point of, hold on, I want to be able to like build stuff, pull data myself from databases, set up databases, do machine learning, all these things are traditionally in the responsibility of like a data scientist or data engineer. Like, can you tell us more about that moment where you realize like, I want to be empowered to like build and create the data myself?
Yes. So technically that moment was like a slow burn for me. Okay. I had been thinking about like going back to school or getting a data science degree or doing something with analytics or statistics or something along that side of things for probably something like 6 or 7 years.
Wow.
And just because of timing on a number of different life things that like, I'm very much the person who's just like, look, sometimes the universe throws things at you and you just have to listen and go with it. And so these things, time, money, commitment, different job opportunities, different personal life opportunities, like things just kind of kept getting in the way mm-hmm. of doing that. The catalyst that finally made me kind of pull the trigger was twofold. One was we had put out the Women Worth Watching campaign in partnership with the USTA. It included all of the women's leagues, WNBA, USTA, oh my God, NWSL, wow, just blanked. WWE, National Pro Fast Pitch, at the time, the Women's Pro Lacrosse League that was up and going, like just a number of all of these different professional entities, US Women's National Team played a role in it as well, like a number of different professional entities that all played into this campaign that went out the door that quoted a statistic that said that 4% of sports media coverage covers women's sports. And then the other 96% is only focused on men's sports. And so the inequity of that really resonated. And we created this whole campaign around it to say, look, you, the fan, can actually be a change maker in this. With the power of social media alone right now, like we all have these platforms, we all have this ability. So using the hashtag Women Worth Watching, we want to see the women who are inspiring you. And that can be both on the field and off it, because we appreciate that there are incredible women in sport who might be general managers or coaches or athletic trainers or statisticians, like, you know, data analysts, like there are any number of different kind of women in these roles who are inspiring the space. And we want to hear their stories. Mm-hmm. And we launched that around the US Open in 2019, did a huge push. It was intended to be a 6, maybe 8 week campaign at a push. And it ended up turning into an evergreen campaign. We had in just those 6 weeks, we had nearly 500 million impressions. And we had 4.2 million engagements online. More than 25,000 unique authors posting about their own stories and using the hashtag. It went over to the UK, and they're, you know, part of the Women's Premier League over there started using it. It went over to Australia and the WNBA equivalent of their Women's Pro Basketball League started using it as one of their core campaigns. Like it really took on its own legs. Mm-hmm. And has even to this day, like it just got used at the end of 2020 for the US Women's Open for golf. And they put a whole Women Worth Watching campaign around it. And so it was in that moment, it was through doing that campaign that I kind of looked at it and I went, here's this insane number. And I don't have any further contextual understanding of it. And what's worse is that this insane number, this 4% number, is actually, when you dig a little bit deeper, is from a study that was done in 2015. Using 2014 data. So it's incredibly old. And then even further, it only covers linear TV. So it didn't go into any of the digital channels. And so what I started then looking at is going, okay, so we're sitting on a number that gets used really frequently as like a, hey, we need to fix this. We need this to change. But the updated research, the updated data analysis of what this statistic really stands for and what the current landscape really looks like isn't actually in place. And so that was kind of that moment where I sat there and I went, we need better data. We need better understanding. We need better systems accessible to this side of the sports business so that they can truly evaluate what the monetary opportunity really is, like in that chicken and egg conversation that happens way too often of people saying, okay, well, we need more money and TV coverage and sponsorship and investment and all of this stuff in the women's sports space. And then brands and media going, okay, well, when the fans show up and when there are butts in seats and, you know, millions of eyeballs on the screen, then it will make sense to invest. Mm-hmm. And it just goes back and forth because then the fans are sitting there going, well, cool. But if you made it more consistently available, I would watch more. And it's this constant kind of cycle. I just started looking at that and going, I want to be able to build the right data systems to super serve this conversation and this side of the business in a more fluent way. And it's not currently accessible with the data teams that, you know, are used on the men's side. Those are $1 million plus contracts that are being put in place. And it's just not something that women's sports has just yet in terms of a P&L to be able to put that type of and that level of spend against data. But it doesn't negate the fact that if we want more investment, if we want that 4% number to be properly reevaluated and to increase, we need to have the right data in place. So that was the one really kind of big catalyst. And then the second was quite frankly, the pandemic.
Okay.
Everybody was sitting at home and I was looking at, you know, kind of the future of our space and just going, if I don't do this now, I am going to miss out on the opportunity to truly build something revolutionary and to truly build something that helps, that makes an impact. Everybody is now switching gears. It's all remote work. The entire concept of how we best utilize technology 1,000% shifted. Mm-hmm. And that was just the final, I don't know, straw that broke the camel's back, like however you want it, in a less negative way, because it was actually a really positive kind of, you know, light bulb moment. And I had already been accepted into the Columbia program at the end of 2020 and had deferred to the spring semester. And so, you know, called up the admissions counselor and said, yes, let's definitely do this. Like, and the class started in May and it was intense. It was an aggressive choice to make when everything was going on during the pandemic. And, you know, we moved houses in the middle of it and moved out of the city. Like we were going through a lot. Like it was a stressful time, but the consistency, the routine, and the challenge of learning this technical side and challenging myself with learning a new coding language was really something that I embraced fully and looked at as, you know, not only is this an opportunity to expand my mindset, but it's an opportunity to finally be able to, in a real brass tacks way, start working on leveling up this space the way that I want to and doing it in a real functional and practical way and actually starting to build out these data systems myself, which is now, it's now what I'm doing. that worked out.
Yeah, that's awesome. Just a quick question on the Columbia program. I mean, there's, especially like I said, during the pandemic, there's so many people turning to learning online, whether it's LinkedIn Learning, which was previously, I guess, Lynda, or, you know, all these other kind of like where you can take data science or data classes. Why did you pick, I think Columbia, it's like the data science Institute. Is that right?
So they actually do it through their School of Engineering.
Okay.
Is it the Foo School of Engineering? I don't know the actual name of it.
Right. Yeah. It's like,
but foods. Yes.
Yeah.
They do it through their School of Engineering. It was typically, my class was actually the first class to go completely virtual. So usually it is an in-person class that they have on the campus. But obviously by the time that we were to May of 2020, New York was in complete shutdown mode and, you know, nobody was trying to show up in person to anything. So yeah, that was, and it was difficult. I'm not going to sugarcoat like the transition to virtual learning, especially when you're doing 20 hours of classes, probably another 10 to 15 hours minimum, sometimes 20 hours of homework and kind of outside of the class work every single week. Like, it was a full-time job on top of my full-time job to be able to balance that, to the point that actually about halfway through the class, I actually ended up stepping out of the day-to-day operations with Shias because I knew that I wanted to focus on this work and on what I was doing through this course. It's a lot to do it in a space where you can't just easily sit down, especially with, you know, we would do group projects and you're having to carve out time during the week to, you know, code with everyone and learn at the same time, you know, in these spaces that you can't just look over at somebody's screen and quickly go, oh yeah, what if you, you know, whatever, use this function here, or what if you tried, you know, using this, whatever it is, like, you know, and just kind of that in-person exchange that is way more conducive and productive when it comes to, especially in a learning space. That was definitely a challenge. But ultimately what it's then set me up for is we're still completely remote. My current engineer lives down in Florida. And, you know, so working with her on what we're building out with the current system and rebuilding parts of our current data engine, building out and taking in this new data that we are and cleaning all of that is happening completely in this virtual space. And had I not gone through the Columbia program, I think I would have been much more apprehensive about that stepping into this role. Now this just feels like a complete continuation of workflow from what I literally the environment that I learned in. So yeah, okay. It's been really helpful. The Columbia choice itself initially was based on location, because like I said, I got accepted into that program at the end of 2019. At that time, I thought that it was going to be an in-person program. So I was looking at either really Columbia or NYU as being the two where I thought that would be feasible to be in person. And so then when everything went virtual, yes, technically I could have picked a different program. To that point, actually, I looked at Flatiron, I looked at some of the other bootcamp programs that are in New York and just decided that the Columbia program was a combination of, I really liked the curriculum. I liked the outline for how they were planning to teach everything. They brought in a really good mix of both really back-end technical, like you're definitely learning to code in Python, you're learning SQL, you're learning whatever, the entire ETL process. But then they're also going through things like Tableau and Hadoop and, you know, kind of the other side to data storytelling that, you know, really creates a kind of full stack approach to the learning that I really appreciated. So yeah, it ended up being a great choice.
In terms of a project you worked on while you're doing this program, can you think of like a really like challenging time when it comes to any of the programming languages, any of the like you mentioned Hadoop, like, you know, big data systems or frameworks that you found challenging, interesting, how you got over it? Like, what were some of the kind of interesting things you learned about those languages or frameworks? I think everyone always has a different experience when going through these boot camps. Curious, like, what kind of things you found challenging and how you overcame them?
So I'll use our final project that actually is a great example of this. We were a team of six, and the final project the main criteria was that it needed to integrate machine learning in some way into what we did. We needed to use a big data source of some sort. We ended up using a couple of different APIs and pulling from APIs rather than, I guess there are some alternatives that we could have gone with. And we ended up evaluating the impact of COVID on player performance in the NBA and in the WNBA. And so starting to look at a couple of different things. One, could we find any correlations between fans not being in the stands and player performance going up? And so could we train basically a model on looking at historic data and then comparing that to the player performance data that existed for just the time when teams were in the bubble. Mm-hmm. Much easier to do for WNBA because they played their entire 2020 season in a bubble versus NBA. Like, we had this kind of split season thing. They had already started their season. So it was a little bit easier to see with W, but mm-hmm. then the issue with the W was that they have far less available data out in the world. So with one of the APIs that we were pulling from, they had a great API. It's the Sports Reference API, which is not associated with Sports Reference, ironically. Anyway, so they have this great API that only covers men's sports. So it's got wonderful documentation, and it has all of these different, you know, you can pull in from going 10 years back, all of this different like player performance, game data, all of these different statistics to be able to pull in and analyze. And they had very up-to-date, like it went up to real time. So when we mm-hmm. were doing this, we were able to look at all of the 2020 bubble stats, as well as this great historic database. WNBA was not included in that. So for WNBA, we had to go and manually pull from the Sports Reference website, which again, not associated with each other, manually pull down CSVs for all of the different data charts and tables and everything, and then manually upload those into our model mm-hmm. and start to be able to start training. So just the, again, from a learning perspective, that's great. Like, you're learning the various different ways to pull the data. From a time perspective, it was super frustrating because we had a week and a half to put together this final project. So you're looking at literally a 10-day period for us to try and fine-tune and train at least one machine learning model. We actually ended up going through three. And in doing that, just any sort of like manual pull like that made it super tedious. We ultimately, with all of the data that we started looking at, were not able to fully train any of the models because of the inconsistencies between some of the data that we were pulling down, especially on the WNBA side. Even then, when we tried to only train the model on the NBA side of things and focus them separately, the NBA side still consistently kind of came up with inconsistencies across the data itself because, and you'll know this as a basketball player, the players don't always stay with the same teams. So when you're training the model and using an individual player's statistics, there are a lot of outlying factors that play into that, including which team he's playing on, who his other teammates are, the different just aspects of like, was there an injury that year? Like, you know, maybe if your star player on the team got injured, like maybe this player had a chance to step up and play more often or get more game time. So there were just all of these different variances that created a level of inconsistency from a data perspective that actually made training the model really difficult. And something that had we had longer than a week and a half, we definitely could have kept training it. And I have confidence that like, we would be able to figure out and like create like a solid model, but to do it in a week and a half became a feat that was unfortunately not super accomplishable. So instead what we ended up going with were linear regressions, which the big joke in the data world is that when you can't figure out machine learning, you go with linear regressions, which ended up showing to a certain extent, like the correlation that we wanted to show that, you know, when most of the players, when they were in the bubble, they actually ended up playing better on both the WNBA and the NBA side of things. There were obviously some anomalies in that and some outliers, but we were able to show that for the most part, when we analyzed just a straight kind of plotting out the various different points, assists, I think there were like five different criteria that we went against for the entire kind of evaluation of a given player's stats. We saw a general upward correlation to being either a faster player, higher points, or overall just like stronger teammate to the team, like more productive rebounds and free throws and stuff like that, like on the various different criteria, like a lot of the overall performance went up. So it was interesting, but it was just, again, like challenges on the data collection side for sure, tons of challenges on the cleaning side, and just trying to create some sort of consistency out of what otherwise became very, very inconsistent data. And then the final challenge was just a lack of time and needing more time. As I'm sure you can appreciate, like machine learning models should never be done in a week and a half. Like those, some people do their entire master's degrees and spend literally years shaping one model. So we just needed more time to be able to truly work through it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the one study I read about the NBA with impacts from COVID was that since players aren't traveling from coast to coast as much, they're not getting in, they don't get jet lag as much, and they're not kind of adjusting their bodies. So it put everyone on a very level playing field. Yep. And therefore the true talent and the best teams came out with the, you know, 2020 finals. So it was a very kind of qualitative study. I don't think it involved like a lot of data, like what you guys were doing, which was actually taking real data sets and kind of trying to train a model or do a linear regression. This is a little more qualitative to talk to the players that, and ask them, hey, how are you feeling today? Are you feeling sleepy? And people are just saying like, yeah, we're well rested, no outside distractions because we're in a bubble and basketball was their life 24/7.
Yeah. And there's something really interesting to be said too, because like other leagues actually started doing this where they were evaluating just the impact of having screaming fans all around you. Like there have been studies and different like data analysis things, projects that have been done in the past over home team advantage, right? Mm-hmm. Like everybody's familiar with those, but what happens when there's no team advantage? Like that's a very leveling the playing field type of atmosphere. It's also really interesting to evaluate from the referee's perspective. So a couple of the different leagues, NBA included, I know NHL did it. Not sure if NFL ever did, but they started evaluating if there weren't booing fans, did that actually have any impact on like penalties called or fouls or anything like that. And there was a positive correlation between no fans being present and there being less penalty calls because there wasn't this, like the hypothesis, the assumption is that there isn't this like egging on that's coming from the fans or a pressure that's coming from the fan base that whenever your referees are sitting there and going, even subconsciously, responding to that pressure from the fans. So it is really interesting to evaluate, and we will continue, I'm sure, to see more data analysis and insights coming out of what last year was for the sports industry, because as as people continue to work on these various different models and various different ways of analyzing that data, and as more data becomes publicly available and kind of open sourced, you're going to have an opportunity to evaluate the short and long-term effects on players, on the leagues, on the fan base, on the overall engagement that is happening in those environments, which is, that's what I nerd out on. Like, I'm like, I hardcore nerd out on that stuff.
Yeah, I feel like ever since Moneyball, you know, this has been a really big emphasis for a lot of teams and the analysts that work with these teams. So it's definitely a really big area. So you graduated from, well, you got this certificate. You have all these amazing new technical skills. How did you find your current role at Sports Innovation Lab, and what type of projects do you work on, or how are you using your skills now that you've gained in your current role at Sports Innovation Lab?
So the role at Sports Innovation Lab, I'm quite literally came out of nowhere. I had started looking around for different jobs, but I had said to myself that there were a couple of things. One, I really wanted to make sure that in the next role, I wasn't completely dismissing everything that the past 15 years of my career have been. Like, I think that there's a lot of really valuable just experience and insight that I gained from working on the business and partner facing side of data. And so I didn't want to miss out on that. I wanted to be able to utilize that in my storytelling and how I worked with the data, but also now obviously leveling up with having these technical skills. So now, you know, I can really go in, and as we're working through and cleaning data, I can get in there and very much do it myself as much as the engineers are, or it gives me a much deeper level and better level of appreciation for how we are actually, how we are truly parsing through the data and looking for different insights, how we are cleaning and structuring the data and going about that in a way that tries to limit biases as much as possible. It's never completely unbiased, and also tries to data validate all of our hypotheses with real data, like making sure that we are truly pulling in from a data first perspective. So as I started like kind of looking around for roles, I was looking with kind of that balance in mind, mm-hmm. And started interviewing at a few different places. And then Angela Ruggiero, who is the co-founder and CEO of Sports Innovation Lab, and who I've known for a few years and my husband has known for many, many years. She is a four-time Olympian and a hockey Hall of Famer and a Harvard undergrad and business grad, just an absolutely insanely talented and smart woman. And she and I had, you know, talked at various points because of my work with She Is. And of course, this is a very small industry and our paths crossed often enough. And so she had called me in December and said, hey, you know, we're building this thing with the fan project and we really want She Is to be involved. And she didn't know that I had stepped out of the day-to-day of She Is. And so when I told her that, I went, yeah, actually, you know, I'm no longer in the day-to-day operations, like happy to put you in touch, but I only kind of serve as an advisory role. She goes, oh, well, there's a much different conversation that we need to have then. What are you doing now?
Right.
I went, okay, great. And so that started what then became really getting to know kind of the intricate levels of their team and their engine and the type of work not only that they have been doing over the past 5 years with Google and the NHL and FIFA and any other number of kind of big sports names that you want to bring out there and tech names. And now starting to move into this women's sports space. And so that just fired on all cylinders for me. Like, not only do I think that Angela is just, and her co-founder, Josh, who is, you know, my boss, are just incredible human beings and people, you know, the right people to found this type of business. But the work that they are doing is, again, going back to that second pillar that I really wanted, like making sure that everything is truly data validated, which in other industries is not a revolutionary concept. In the sports industry, it still very much is. Like once you start going outside of player stats and the money balling, essentially, of this space, like that has become very advanced, in part because it affects the actual business of drafting players and what that whole process looks like, but also because it affects betting. And sports betting, as it becomes legalized across more states, is becoming an absolute huge money driver and exponentially growing. And so player stats and game stats and analytics around that has a direct monetary impact. So the more that you put into that, the more revenue you have the chance to drive. Business data, on the other hand, the other side of the business, understanding fan engagement metrics and what fan behavior truly looks like is probably a solid 5 years behind. Mm-hmm. So if you look at what's happening in the music industry, in the entertainment industry, even in the CPG industry, and you know, brand loyalty and how they get consumers to engage with their products. Like there are a lot of other industries that have really started to utilize data and to build out systems and models that are quite intricate and really impressive and are really evaluating fan and consumer behavior at its core. The sports industry hasn't quite grasped that. And that's what Sports Innovation Lab is really focused on doing, is saying, look, like you have to understand the behaviors first, even before you try looking at demographics. Because if you don't have a core understanding of the fan behavior that is happening, especially before, during, and after a game or an event or something in that space, you're missing out on a very contextual piece of who your fan is and how they are potentially going to interact with your team, your brand, your athletes. So it's a really integral and kind of missing piece and part of that puzzle. Mm-hmm. And so it really, really drew me both to what they have already built as a business, but really the potential for what I could help them build was around that idea and understanding. And because I have all of the experience coming from, and so this goes to my first pillar that I really wanted to make sure was a part of this, that goes back to all of that experience from what we built at Spotify and what we built and used at Viacom. And even quite frankly, like going back as far as 15 years ago, that was when we were first starting to do mobile couponing and understanding the consumer behavior around mobile. So like there's all of these things that have been seemingly kind of disparate parts of my career that now in this role and in what Sports Innovation Lab is doing, I feel have kind of all culminated into a, okay, I'm able to take real learning from these other places that I've existed in and that I've helped to build and bring that into this environment. And oh, by the way, it's also paired with my love and like extreme level passion for women's sports and what they're doing with that. So it just really hit on all cylinders. And has only, I mean, I've been with them now for 2 months and that's only continued to be reaffirmed.
That's awesome. What a great story. I know we're getting close to almost an hour now, and I want to be respectful of your time. But one thing I like to always ask everyone kind of near the end is what tools, what data tools specifically that could be commercial paid tools or open source that you're most excited about learning in the next 3, 6, 9 months, either on your job or I guess it'd be for your job, but what kind of tools you're most excited about learning and using? And also why?
So there are a few here. One, we have started using Shiny a lot for building out just different internal dashboards. And it was actually a tool that I had never used before, but the team had used and our current engineer had used pretty frequently. Mm-hmm. And it has been wonderful. Like, one of, I think, the challenges that data science typically has is that conversion from raw data, definitely to structured data and the cleaning process that comes into that. But then what's that next step to be able to properly and efficiently communicate to stakeholders in a centralized way, in a way that will make sense, and in a way that presents, again, a data-driven insight or opportunity or whatever that may be. And the shiny environment has been really helpful for that, and allowing us to very, very easily navigate what some of the structured data looks like, but even then being able to poke holes in some of the structured data and say, like, hey, actually, I'm noticing, for example, like when we're searching for these key terms in our data against these key dates or whatever, we're seeing spikes in other areas. Can we actually go back to the raw data and clean for a broader, like, timeline around that particular one, rather than just being honed in on that one day, for example? Like, we'll look at the full week. So there are ways of kind of doing a back and forth through this environment that have been really helpful to our team. Mm-hmm. Second, that the team wasn't using before, but is something that, and this is going to be sacrilegious for me to say for some data analysts, and I appreciate that, but I'm a hybrid. So that's where this is coming from. I really appreciate the environment that Tableau has created. Mm-hmm. From a business intelligence perspective, it is something that, again, as I'm navigating a company in an environment that has really, really intelligent people and really, I mean, just high performers, there is, I will never put an expectation on a sales team, for example, to have the level of intricate data knowledge and statistical knowledge that me and my team do. Like, that's just not fair to put on them. So Tableau lets us create environments that allow them to still explore the data and tell really powerful stories to our clients and to the people that they're directly interfacing with, without having to get into a real technical level of kind of analysis and deep dive with the data, mm-hmm. which has been really helpful in terms of how we're building out dashboards and building out environments. And again, I know that that's a little touchy for some people. Like, a lot of people say, nope, do everything in Python and put it into D3 visualizations and, you know, create your own whatever HTML environments and, like, do that yourself. And I believe in that route too. I'm not discounting that route. And we do that as well. But there's a level of kind of streamlining that is able to happen very easily. And when you're a small team, you need that. Like, there are some things that we can just more easily do through Tableau. And then the third and final one that I have, again, just started learning, but is something that our engineer works really frequently in, is actually RStudio. Mm-hmm. That, you know, the Columbia program touched a little bit on R, but we mostly did focus on Python. And so what's been really fun to explore with this new role is, I mean, Tanya, our engineer, is insanely talented, like just an absolute whiz with things, and has been using RStudio for years now. And so being able to learn that environment through the work with her has been really, really incredible. And for as much as I promoted, like, I do find Python to be a little bit more intuitive between the languages, I absolutely get the value in the environment that exists with RStudio and find a lot of value in that myself, which is great.
Cool. These are three amazing tools that I haven't really heard mentioned too often. So it's good that you're using some of these open source things and finding a lot of value in them. So cool. Well, thanks so much, Katie. I know we've been talking for almost an hour, and just thank you so much for your time and explaining and just kind of giving us your insights about your career and how you ended up where you are. And hopefully we'll see really amazing things from you in Sports Innovation Lab in the years to come.
Absolutely. And if I may, as a shameless plug to your listeners,
for sure,
we are currently hiring. So if you want to come and do this amazing work with me and with the team, if you work well in startup environments, especially, and you have a love for sports, we are hiring for another mid-level engineer and analysts and building out a full pool of analysts. So I would definitely open it up to all of your listeners. Please feel free. I will make sure that, I don't know, my email address is included in the description.
Yep.
But yes, please reach out. I would love to talk to you, especially women and people of color. I'm really, really focused on making sure that as we are building our team, that we are bringing diversity first and foremost into the hiring practices, to ensure that we have tons of different perspectives at the table. Because that's how bias creeps into data, is when that diversity doesn't exist. So I'm really hyper-focused on that too.
For sure. We'll definitely include that, any links and your email in the show notes for people to inquire within.
Perfect.
Well, thanks again. Hopefully have a good rest of your day, and we'll keep in touch.
Sounds good. Thank you.